one of our first visitors is Karen. Karen Hussey, who's the director of a very similarly named institute, but with an overlapping but somewhat different mission, the Centre for Policy Futures at University of Queensland. Karen is also will be chair of the scientific board of our Centre of Research Excellence if we get it funded. So we'll see what happens there. And Karen and I have a joint interest in the issues of technological progress and how society and the policy communities handle this rapid emergence of new technologies. Now, there are many kinds of new technology, but in particular, I think there's a lot of focus now on the class of technologies you could call digital and digital-related technologies, where, to a certain extent, there's been a very laissez-faire approach to their regulation, and now we're seeing a lot of consequences of that. And the issues of, if this is the forerunner of much more rapid and pervasive technological development, emerging quickly, often out of the private sector with very little warning, but with very rapid potential uptake, the upsides and downsides, how do you design and think about both social license issues, policy issues, and regulatory issues around new technologies? And so Karen and I have been talking about that quite a lot, and also Matthias Kaiser from Bergen, who's here with us for the next few months, who's a professor of, and former director of the Center for Science and Humanities at the University of Bergen. Anyhow, I'm going to stop here, turn over to Karen, and hear some of the interesting things that her centre has been doing, and which led to a very powerful report that I think is what she's referring to on
That's
the bottom of the slide.
The report down there, which is available on our website. Thank you, Peter, and thank you very much for the invitation and to the Institute of Public Policy for hosting this seminar, or co-hosting this seminar. My plan is to spend 5, 6, 7 minutes max talking about the set of policy futures, the way in which we're structured, the work we do. And then to provide an oversight of the, sort of the findings from that report, which I'll divide into two parts. It is half of a four-part research program that we're prosecuting over the next couple of years in the centre, and informal. Ask questions as you go. I'm happy to answer them. So the set of the policy futures, we're now in our third year, and we are small. I like to call us the little engine that could, for those of you that remember that childhood cartoon. We're just over 11 staff, half core funded, half on sort of external soft funding arrangements. And we have four research themes and one sort of cross-cutting research theme. So the first one is on science, technology and society, which is essentially what I'll be presenting on today. But our biggest partnership at the moment is with CSIRO, our national research organisation in Australia. And essentially they came to us and said, we're a government agency, we're not really allowed to talk about policy and regulation, but we know that our eight future science platforms have quite profound implications for societies, and consequently we need to think about what the policy and regulatory implications are. Will you do that thinking? And so we said yes. So that's, at the moment, almost all of our science, technology and society work is with CSIRO, and we have three positions associated with that. The second theme is in relation to security, development, foreign policy, and we have close working relationships with the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. One of those areas relates to cybersecurity, particularly the way in which defence and strategic studies people conceive of cybersecurity. So if, for example, a foreign entity, whether that be a state actor or otherwise, should interfere with our infrastructure in Australia to the extent that someone dies, is that an act of war? And if it's an act of war, what does that mean we do in terms of response? So where do you draw those boundaries in a space that is really untested? The third area is in relation to environment, energy and sustainability, and our closest partner there is the Department of Environment and Science, as part of the Queensland Government, and we've spent the last 2 years working with them on climate change policy, really down to the nuts and bolts of what kind of policy interventions is the Queensland Government allowed to introduce, and is it politically feasible to introduce. The long and the short of that is that it's gone almost nowhere because, of course, we are a coal exporting state. But it's been an interesting 2 years. The fourth area relates to justice rights and empowered communities. Two projects in particular to draw attention to there. One is with the Queensland Human Rights Commission. Last year, Queensland Parliament passed a Human Rights Act, which is remarkable in its breadth, so much so that no one really realised it. And so every government agency is now having to think about, well, what does the Human Rights Act mean for us? And we're working particularly in relation to health, the right to access health services. And in a state like Queensland, which is highly distributed outside southeast Queensland, that raises some really interesting questions around resource distribution and liability. And then a second project in relation to justice rights and empowered communities is in relation to Murray Court, which is a court specifically for Indigenous people. And that's looking at the implications of applying new technologies in the Murray Court system and what that means for Indigenous people's engagement with the Murray Court. So, for example, like a lot of the rest of the judicial system in Australia, they've started to bring in fingerprinting. So you can't access the court unless you give your fingerprint. Now, for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, giving their fingerprint is not something they feel comfortable doing. Frankly, it's not something I feel comfortable doing either. But it's too late for me because I'm visiting the United States, so it's probably everywhere. But it has been incredibly prohibitive, for example, clients of the court, to have family visit them because the family doesn't want to give over their fingerprints. So we're working with the Murray Court to think about how you might get what they want without taking fingerprints. But it'll extend to DNA testing and things like that, almost inevitably. So that's the four domains across the top. And then we have something which we've only just introduced, which is systems design and futures thinking, tools and analytics for decision makers. We were doing this anyway, but I realized that we weren't actually giving the methodologies and the decision support space enough of a Guernsey in terms of how we profile ourselves. So one project there is with the Secretary of the Pacific Community, where we're helping them to think about what SPC as an intergovernmental science organisation might look like in 10 years' time. So it's a highly politicised space. They like to think it's not because it's science, but science is a highly politicised space. And if you take something like SPC, which is short on cash, and you've got donors from north of the Pacific who are offering funds, what do you do? Where do you envisage yourself? So we're using futures thinking methodologies to enable them to think about that. So that's the sort of the content, if you like, or the thematic focus of the centre. And of course, we've got 12 disciplines. And I was saying to colleagues earlier that what's interesting, I think, about our staff is that very few of them have one disciplinary background. It's a kind of a self-selecting process. You know, if you're interested in policy and impact, you get some way through your career before you realise, hang on a minute, I can't do this with one discipline alone. So we also have three areas of activity. The usual stuff in terms of research, the high impact journals are kind of core business for us. The way I explain it to our staff is, if we're not doing this, we may as well be consultants and get paid for it, right? So this is what sets us apart from everybody else. But we also do non-traditional research outputs, and that's a picture of the report that I'll refer to, we'll present on for the rest of this 30 minutes or so. And that's really about saying journal articles take forever to get published. Policy decisions are made every day. We need to be much faster. And so we have a whole series of ways in which we get our research. Either it sets our research agenda or we get our research into the policy-making process. We also, in the policy engagement program, have a number. You did warn me. a number of activities. One of which is quarterly briefings with Queensland Parliament. So they pick the topic, and we put together a panel and curate it, and then do private briefings. We also have a partnership with the Winston Churchill Trust. I don't know how much your endowment is in New Zealand for the Winston Churchill Trust, but ours sends about 110 fellows overseas every year. And then nothing happens with the reports, unless the particular fellow decides to take it upon themselves to do something with it. So I rang the CEO of the Winston Churchill Trust in Australia, and I said, mate, you're putting about $4 million a year into some bloody good research and international comparative analysis. How about we partner and we'll find the top 10 policy reform ideas from each year and put them out to the secretaries and the deputy secretaries, etc., etc. So that's that. And then finally, we have capacity building within the university, which consists of a whole load of things, but that's the group training, getting research into policy and practice. So that's what we do. If there's no questions on that, I'll move straight into the report. So under theme one, science, technology and society, we decided that we were interested in three things in relation to new technologies. The benefits and risks that they may pose, and consequently where policy and or regulation is needed, where existing policy, regulatory and market settings may pose barriers to their successful development, and consequently where policy reforms may be needed, and finally where government agencies and departments, whether government agencies and departments are fit for purpose in their capacity to identify and manage risks and opportunities now and over time, and consequently where administrative reforms may be necessary. So that kind of ring fences what we do in the science, technology and society space. We developed a four-part research program which started with the need for definitional clarity about what each technology and innovation is and how it's different to existing technologies. This was born almost entirely, comrades, from frustration. I went to meeting after meeting after meeting with our colleagues in science engineering where they would tell me, wax lyrical, about synthetic biology, about artificial intelligence, about bioeconomy. And when, as a trade person, I said to them, what are the goods and services that you're producing from these technology platforms, they were not able to tell me, right? Because it was very much up here in the technology pipeline. It was very much pure. And yet they wanted to go to government and ask for money. My response was, you're not going to get money unless you can communicate to a policymaker and the treasurer what the goods and services are that you will ultimately be selling. So we really wanted definitional clarity about what some of these big, sexy terms were, right? And personally, I've never heard of synthetic biology until 3 years ago. Is it a new field? No, it's not. Right? But somebody said, let's call it synthetic biology. And different universities in different parts of the world call it something different. The second aim was to develop an analytical framework to unpack the key processes, products, and services that are produced along the pipeline so that we could support decision makers to understand where intervention may be needed. The third was to identify what those interventions might be, because there will be impediments almost certainly, and how would we do it in a way that was politically, technically, and economically feasible. So we're up to here. And we've applied the framework to circular economy, and if you have time, I can go through that. But it's really designed for anybody. It's open access, and it's meant to be useful. So we looked at four technologies: nanotechnology, synthetic biology, artificial intelligence, and circular economy. Noting that circular economy is more of an innovation around business models rather than a technology per se. It will, by definition, draw on technologies, but it's an innovation in business models. So, what did we find? We found that there are four features of new and emerging technologies that we think are genuinely different, and consequently, regulators need to be aware of them as distinct features. Now, I should say that in doing this part of the research, we did bring in bioeconomy and also advanced manufacturing. Why? Because the Department of State Development in Queensland has roadmaps, technology roadmaps, and one of them is advanced manufacturing. When I met with the minister to discuss what advanced manufacturing might look like, well, you know, it's robots and stuff, right? In fact, this lies at the heart of everything. Okay, digitization and AI is what lies behind advanced manufacturing. What is advanced manufacturing? Don't know, really. It's just doing stuff more efficiently and quicker. Okay? So, the four features. The first we call technology splitting, and that is the capacity for a technology to rapidly proliferate into new applications in ways that are hard to predict. So yes, you start with the pacing problem. Peter referred to it. Technology is being developed incredibly fast now. and regulation is struggling to keep up. But it's also being applied in sectors that you wouldn't have picked from the outset, which means that the people who regulate those sectors don't necessarily know that it's coming or, in fact, that it's already there. Genetics and genomics is one example. So we lead the policy and regulatory component of something called the Reef Restoration and Adaptation Program, which is about the application of new science and engineering techniques on the Great Barrier Reef in order to build resistance to corals to warmer ocean temperatures. A suite of those interventions contain assisted evolution, genetic modification, the use of gene editing, etc., etc. So there's a whole lot of social scientists talking about whether or not we actually want to do that on the Great Barrier Reef. And then there's us, and we're sort of saying, well, crap, who's going to regulate that? So we rang the Office of the Gene Technology Regulator and said, so we say coral reefs and you say, oh, shit, right? Because they're used to agriculture and they're used to health, but not the entirely uncontrolled environment that is the ocean. So they were talking about, we spent a long time with them talking about how you would test this science once it got beyond the lab stage. And they were saying, well, what we need, the scientists were saying, was we need an isolated reef. forgive my ignorance, but what the heck is an isolated reef? Well, it's one that's far away from everything else. But doesn't the water around the reef move? Yes. So a lot of this was the regulators in Canberra trying to get their heads around how you would even begin to regulate this type of intervention, never mind the social science and whether or not it would be acceptable. Okay. The second area is the Internet of Things. All right, and so this is where you might assume that you're going to have the internet used in relation to telecommunications, but actually you find it's being used on roads by virtue of Uber. Okay. But if you're a road traffic authority, you don't wake up every morning and go, wow, my job is managing the internet. Okay. So that's technology splitting. The consequences are new domains for existing regulators or the need for new regulators. And, of course, collaboration, coordination, and new skills development amongst regulators so that they can see this coming. The second area is technology convergence. So two previously separate technologies become combined such that they create a new technology or a novel application through their interaction. So in the old days, we had what we called piggybacking, which is where you put two technologies together and they either make the original function more efficient or somehow more innovative. Okay? So some bright spark a long time ago said if you put the stick on the end of an axe, you get a spear. But ultimately, you're still doing the same thing. You add the internet and artificial intelligence to cars and you get driverless cars, but they're still cars. Okay, so it's a linear escalation of what that technology does. But then you have something like the iPhone, which is not just a phone. You add the internet and artificial intelligence to the phone and what you get is a remarkable piece of technology that allows you to book, to track your cat, take films, photographs, check your emails, go on the internet, run an entire business. So it's a paradigmatic shift. And we call that technology convergence. The consequences are it's almost impossible to guess what the technology might be used for and which regulators should care and at what point they should care. And in many ways, it's too late. The third area is new economic value, and that's the sudden usefulness and monetary value of otherwise prosaic goods such as data and genes. So until you've created a technology that relies on them, they're worthless. But all of a sudden we have a technology that makes them incredibly valuable. The example we use in the report is crude oil. It was really just a geological curiosity until the Industrial Revolution. Right? Oh, look, crude oil. Wonder where that came from. And then you have the internal combustion engine, and all of a sudden crude oil becomes an incredibly important input to another technology, which changes the geopolitics of the entire planet, which we are now trying to unravel. Okay? But the other, of course, is data and waste. So my particular area of interest is in the circular economy and the new economic value that we're affording to waste. So for me, it's about saying, well, are we able to just use that product, that input, waste, in terms of paper, if it suddenly has new and economic value, is it easy? Does it just become a market and you don't have to do anything else with it? The answer is no, because the way we define waste at the moment means that you cannot use it in other economic processes. You can't store it in particular places, it has to be particular on zone. Okay? So there are real regulatory barriers to that taking place. The consequences are that regulators must consider new technologies, not only in terms of their processes, outputs, and outcomes, but also in terms of their inputs. You'd all be familiar with the ownership, consent, transferability, and sovereignty issues related to data. And, of course, there's the global impacts and international political economy dimensions. Now, the scale of impact relates to, say, the fossil fuel example, but we also have what's called technologically critical elements, TCEs. So some of you might have seen, I don't know if you have it here in New Zealand, but last week there was a great program in Australia on child labour used in mining for coltan. Coltan is a critically important mineral for iPhones and other electronic products. So what you end up with is elements that are not only possess, have new economic value, but also bring about other deleterious outcomes for society. So finally, we had regulatory divergence and the notion of jurisdiction. Okay? Innovation has been globalized since the Industrial Revolution. Yes, we know that. But the speed of transfer has transfer across borders, within and across borders, has accelerated, and the complexity of technology has increased. Similarly, where technology and innovation is produced has changed markedly in the last 6 or 7 decades. So a paper I did 5 years ago, a book chapter I did 5 years ago, looked at what it was like 50 or 60 or 70 years ago, and you could really pinpoint the handful of research institutes around the world that were producing the most patents. That's now blown out of the water, and similarly, you're having all sorts of innovations take place in garages, or in jurisdictions that don't have robust regulatory frameworks, or that have robust regulatory frameworks that don't encompass the same values and principles that we do. So divergences in regulatory approaches, which in turn reflect different values and principles, provokes challenges for regulators in protecting domestic public good outcomes and indeed commercial exchange. So our social science colleagues get very exercised, quite rightly, about public good outcomes. My colleagues in business and economics get very exercised about impediments to commercial exchange. But one way or another, we're talking about an impediment. So geopolitical dynamics make this particularly difficult for small countries, and I would refer here to international standard setting. So in the old days, when there was a small, powerful group of Western nations that frankly wrote the rules, we didn't have to worry about that. Okay? Now we do. Okay? Because we have clashes at the international level which filter down to the way we experience technology now. So, my view is that we have to reinforce global institutions and international fora, and we need renewed effort and mutual recognition. That was the definitional clarity aim of the research program. And out of that came an understanding of what the individual technologies are and could be and what they will deliver in terms of goods and services, but also what made them unique, those four things. The second part of the program looked at how we would be able to do this systematically and consistently across any platform as it arises, and not just us, but others. So we looked at developing an analytical framework to unpack the key processes, products, and services produced along the technology and innovation pipeline. And this is basically what we came up with. Now, there's months of work in this. It looks wonderfully simple, but months and months of work. And I give particular credit to Chris McEwen, a PhD student of ours in the centre, who's quite a remarkable thinker. But he was very keen on us separating out, because I kept wanting to sort of conflate different parts of it. And in fact, by virtue of us unpacking this, we were able to identify some of those key features that I just talked through. So, the first is the drivers, which along with the outcomes is probably the most obvious part. So it's the why behind innovation. And some are permanent and universal, and others are transient and appear to come and go over time. And of course, a derivative, right? So you know, the driver for renewable energy technology is the need to deal with climate change. But why do we need to deal with climate change? Because we're worried about security, right? Okay. So they're derivative, but slightly different. So it's the transient ones that appear and disappear that fuel the search for solutions. Okay. So for regulators, understanding the drivers behind innovations helps to explain why the investment is an attractive option and is vital to making sense of the perceived benefits of the technology. So you can't actually do your cost-benefit analysis as a regulator unless you understand the driver. And this is, I'll refer back to the reef, the coral reef project. Because myself and all the other social scientists walked in and went, you cannot be serious. You cannot be serious. You want a whole lot of engineering interventions and you want to genetically modify the reef. You've got to be joking. And the scientists came back and said, if we do nothing, we will have no reef. So which do you prefer? Right? So unless you understand what the driver is, you can't put the need and an understanding of the scope for regulation in context. So 12 months working with those people, and I came out the other end going, okay, I think cloud seeding's okay, and I'm all right with assisted evolution, but I just can't quite bring myself to completely radically reforming and modifying corals. But give me another year, I might get there. Particularly if we don't do anything meaningful in climate change. So that's drivers. The point being, of course, that there is a role for regulators in every part of this framework. The second is enablers. So the desire for an innovation to fulfill a driver is not enough. There must be technological, intellectual, and or physical prerequisites in place that enable that technology to emerge at a given time. So the example we use is Leonardo da Vinci, whose driver was, I really want to fly, I'm really fascinated with flying. So Da Vinci puts together this sketch of what he called an aerial screw. Innovation, not quite, because the driver was there but not the enabler. He didn't have the power to power it, the electricity to power it, and nor did he have a profound understanding of aerodynamics. So the aerial screw remained a drawing. So the enablers are the science and technologies that have come before that enable this to be possible. Okay? And the smartphone's a great example of that. Okay? We knew how to take photos, we knew how to make films, we knew how to call someone, but putting it together relied on a whole lot of other technologies that emerge, and in fact manufacturing capability to be able to get everything small enough to work in an iPhone. So regulators must understand enablers because it's often the case that they're the focus of current research and development. So the more that regulators get down and dirty with the types of enabling technologies and innovation that we're working on, the more likely it is that they'll see this stuff coming. How do you do that? That's a whole separate question, but I would argue it needs to be done. The third area is inputs, and that's the raw resources or ingredients which feed into a given emerging technology and upon which its output is reliant. You can't have the technology without the input. And it can be anything from electricity, which is fairly prosaic, to something very specific, like data. We focus on the latter, those resources critical to the emerging technology and whose value is linked to the existence of the technology in question. So you're not worried about electricity, because it's not unique to that technology. But if you want to use, if you want to have, just trying to think of a reef example to keep it consistent. So your input is obviously the coral, but let's say you go all the way to the extreme, it's having the technology in CRISPR-9 to be able to do it. So regulators need to understand the inputs because of their important economic interactions, which are likely to have socioeconomic outcomes. Digitization is critical here. This is where data gets messy, right? Because you have the socioeconomic outcomes that come with not thinking carefully about ownership, consent, sovereignty, and transferability. So then you have processes. So while enablers are those innovations which allow technologies to emerge in the first place, processes are those innovations by which the outputs of the technology is created. So like all innovation, the process involves a novel technology, for example, CRISPR, multiple novel technologies, synthetic biology, which is a suite of technologies, or simply a new way and means of creating an output. So a sharing device is what enabled Uber and Airbnb. Processes are often, or at least they should be, the target of regulators. Now, why? if you take something like artificial intelligence, which by definition is a process, it is processing all the time. It is using new data to feed upon itself, upon itself, upon itself. But if you're not, for example, regulating the type of data that is used in that process, you can be locking in prejudices, which is currently what's happening. So regulators thinking about the way in which processes are undertaken using the inputs available is necessary for us to at least be cognizant of what those prejudices and biases might be. And finally, we have outputs, which is the easy stuff. The goods and services produced as a consequence of the processes when applied to the inputs. And it's the phase at which consumers will interact with the technologies, and of course, regulators must consider the interactions between different goods and services, including those interactions with different sectors. So what you do in one sector might have a consequence for another sector. We tend not to think like that as regulators. So we develop that framework, and the plan from here is to go through those key technology platforms to say, well, what does it look like? And thus, where, if anywhere, do regulators need to get involved? So we started with the circular economy, and I'm conscious of time. Do I have another 5 minutes?
Yeah, sure.
So the circular economy seeks to close the loop. Everyone's heard of the circular economy, right? Is it as sexy here as it is in Australia? You can't get through the week without someone saying we're going to move to a circular economy. Is it new?
No.
Right? It's not new. But we're all pretending it is. So let's go with it. So the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, which is probably the preeminent institution working on this, defines the three goals to achieve a circular economy as designing out waste and pollution, keeping products and materials in use, and regenerating natural systems. In many ways, it's not a new concept, but it has gained significant political traction in Australia, at least, because China, Indonesia, and Malaysia, how dare they, have said they're not going to take our waste anymore. So we can't get rid of the problem anymore, so we have to deal with the problem. I refer you to drivers. Okay? But we're finding it, Peter didn't mention it, but I'm about to move into government, and one of the portfolios that I will have is circular economy, and I've been working with that department for a couple of years. And they have what's called a chief entrepreneur. And the chief entrepreneur has decided that the circular economy is the future for Queensland. So this department was charged with making it happen. And of course, none of them had any qualifications in anything that looked like circular economy or life cycle analysis or engineering processes, anything like that. And they very quickly came unstuck for very genuine reasons that they didn't actually understand what it would look like in practice. So we came back to them with the framework. So what's driving it? Greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets, and awareness of resource scarcity, waste disposal, and whole of life cycle assessment. Regulation. Emission standards for all transport modes is at the moment a real barrier, because we don't actually have decent standards. So what I should say is, what are the barriers or potential enablers in this part of the pipeline? So we have some enablers. We have some policy settings that are saying we ought to do this. And then we have conflicting policy settings or hard regulation that's saying, but on the other hand, we don't really consider this a priority, right? So you end up in a situation of paralysis. We have in market settings the polluter pays principle, but we don't apply it. And that's true of so many things in this space. Now, what are these barriers or potential enablers in this part of the pipeline? So we have the TCFD investor framework for companies and for government procurement. So this is the idea that governments and companies would have to analyze and then reveal to the market what their risks are from climate change, either financial risks, transition risks, or physical impact risks. And by virtue of doing that, we now have thousands of companies that have done it. They are exposing where they have vulnerabilities to either creating too much waste or having it on their books or producing greenhouse gas emissions as a consequence of it. We have integrated supply chain planning, which has been done, and knowledge platforms for local governments. Regulation, similarly, and market settings, the provision of green bonds and transparency and green investment accreditation. So these are drivers that are almost in place, but not quite. They're on the horizon, or at least they are in Australia. You guys are so far ahead of us, you've probably got green bonds coming out of everywhere. We don't. But as soon as we do, that provides a market incentive for companies to start to think about the circular economy principles. In terms of inputs, this is probably where the biggest barriers are, and I referred to it earlier. And that's in relation to how you define waste. So we're going to go from a paradigm where waste was waste and it should be disposed of, and yes, you had to deal with whether or not any of those materials were hazardous, but nevertheless, they were out of sight, out of mind. Now we're saying waste should be something completely different. It is in itself monetized. But we then have to change the way in which we define it. We have to change the zoning laws in relation to where we can store it and how we can use it. And you don't actually get to that unless you start thinking about what those materials are. And of course, the circular economy covers everything from electrical waste to timber, forests. We're working with a large construction company, and apparently in the construction industry, but I'll ask you, what do you think is the biggest, by volume, waste product from construction? What do you reckon it is? I didn't know. No? It's contaminated soil. Contaminated soil, which is virtually impossible to repurpose, unless you can actually remove the contaminants from the soil. So there's a whole market there to be had if you can be the scientist to figure out how you decontaminate the soil, and then you can repurpose it. Oh, and there's, you know, trade barriers, of course. In terms of processes, so what are there? Where are there barriers or potential enablers in terms of processes? So one thing that you could do, and this we put this up to the Council of Australian Governments, was to actually have a coordinated cross-jurisdictional knowledge platform. Why? Because it's a federation and waste moves at the moment north because we don't charge as much for waste disposal as New South Wales and Victoria. So you actually have an entire business that sees waste products from Victoria and New South Wales move to Queensland. We said, first of all, that's perverse, but secondly, why not take advantage of the federation and actually do this collectively across supply chains rather than by administrative jurisdiction, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things that I think has enormous potential is extended producer responsibility. It's been around for a decade or more. The European Union is pushing it really hard. If it could have some teeth, I think extended producer responsibility would be a great regulatory enabler in this space. And then you have the outputs. I won't go through that. So what does it all mean for policymakers and regulators? Well, lots, and we're still working on it. But to begin with, in our view, senior public services, scholars in the regulatory sciences and policy studies domain need to consider four things: the administrative arrangements and resource needs that underpin the policy and regulatory landscape. First of all, who's responsible? So when you go through the framework, which regulator gets nervous or ought to get nervous? And then the second question is, do they have the skills and the resources to be able to understand and then impose some kind of intervention on it? If I go back to the reef example, we have something called the Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, which is the regulator of the reef. You cannot do anything on the Great Barrier Reef without GRUMPA giving you a permit. So we spent a couple of years working very closely with GRUMPA, and honestly, one of their biggest concerns was that there was going to be a whole lot of activity to restore and adapt coral reefs, and they didn't have enough people in the regulator to manage the permitting system because they have a cap under the Act that says they can't have more than 212 people. This is a very basic but important limitation. So what do? Well, they can increase their budget, but they can't increase their numbers. But if they increase their budget, what are they going to do? They're going to outsource it. Who are they going to outsource it to? And do we trust them? Classic regulatory challenge. Right? Because the opportunity for capture is very real. That there is an interesting part to this, and this sort of builds on some work we did with the OECD and some work by a colleague of ours who worked with the World Bank, and that is that actually regulators could also be using these technologies in the way they do their business. There is no reason why a regulator can't go out and deploy artificial intelligence tools to monitor compliance. Okay? But they need to be savvy enough to know that. Okay? And we're talking about government. And then finally, the need to go beyond social license to operate and generate public understanding of the interaction between values and technology. This is happening. You know, there's documentaries about what AI means, or about data ownership and what it means for protection and privacy and consent, but I don't think there's a general understanding amongst our populations about what we're actually risking. And then in terms of our own community, the ways we need to consider the ways in which scientists in particular communicate their work and its potential applications. I think scientists need to be able to have the conversation around drivers, enablers, inputs, processes, and outputs. And I also think there's a key role for people who are particularly good at communicating. We are not known as a community for being very good communicators. And that's a disadvantage when we're talking about interactions with government. And of course, we need to partner with scholars who have experience or expertise in policy-making and regulation, and that's, if you like, where centres like ours, the Centre for Informed Futures, comes in with a very specific mandate. Thank you to Peter and colleagues, particularly Anne and Megan, who's not here, for organising the trip, for Jennifer, for hosting the web, this thing, for New Zealand government, for not prohibiting an Australian from entering your country, and of course, my own colleagues for the excellent work that they put into that report.